You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Casey. I'll be joined shortly by co-host Dennis Wissman. Every once in a while, I read a new book that totally changes how I've been thinking about a particular topic. And I recently read a new book by Bruce Feiler, Life is in the Transitions, Mastering Change at Any Age. And it really helped me think differently about the topic of transitions in life across the life course and lifespan. And we're thrilled today to have the opportunity to talk with Bruce about his book. Bruce Feiler is the author of 6 consecutive New York Times bestsellers, including The Secrets of Happy Families, Walking the Bible, and Council of Dads, which inspired the new NBC drama series. He is the host of 2 primetime series on PBS, and his 2 TED Talks have been viewed more than 2 million times. A native of Savannah, Georgia, he lives in Brooklyn with his wife, Linda Rottenberg, and their twin daughters. We have Bruce's full bio in the show notes and highly recommend you take a look at that as well. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We both read and loved your book, and I was wondering if you could share your personal story that inspired you to write your new book, Life is in the Transitions.
Well, it's funny, we're having this conversation in the middle of a life quake, right? When all of us are going through one of these huge wrenching changes that I call a life quake because it's higher on the Richter scale of consequences and it has aftershocks that last for years. And I got interested in these periods, you know, as you suggest, because I went through a life quake. I just got walloped by life a few years ago. First, I got cancer as a 43-year-old new dad. Then I almost went bankrupt in the last recession. And then my dad, who has Parkinson's, tried to take his own life 6 times in 12 weeks. He just sort of lost control of his mind and had lost the will to live. And we were just struggling in all sorts of ways that you do in this kind of situation. Work crisis, medical crisis, health crisis, dealing with my mom. But I'm the story guy. I'm the meaning guy. So on a whim, one Monday morning, I sat down and I sent him a question. Tell me about the toys you played with as a kid. So he couldn't even move his fingers. He answers this question. And then I sent another one. Tell me about the house you grew up with. And this became this sort of thing that he was so obsessed with and gave him life and brought him back to life in a lot of ways. So this went on for years. Every week I'd send him a question. Tell me, how'd you become an Eagle Scout? How'd you join the Navy? How'd you meet mom? Until he backed into writing an autobiography. And when I thought this was a singular experience that kind of related only to me, but when I told everyone I knew about this, everybody seemed to have a similar story. Like my wife had a headache and went into the hospital and died. My daughter tried to take her own life. My brother just got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. My boss is stealing money from me. And what everybody was saying in one way or the other is the life I'm living is not the life I expected, that I'm living life out of order. And I remember calling my wife one night and saying, Linda, no one knows how to tell their story anymore, and I've got to figure out what I could do to help. And so what I did, not really knowing what I was going to find, to be honest, was I created this thing called the Life Story Project, where I set out over the course of several years, crisscrossed the country, gathering what became hundreds of life stories of Americans of all ages, all walks of life, all 50 states. Who'd been through similar life changes like this, lost homes, lost limbs, changed careers, changed religions, got sober, got out of bad marriages. And then I spent a year with a team of 12 people coding these stories, trying to figure out if there were some themes or takeaways that could help all of us in times of change. So I didn't go seeking transitions, but what I found was this idea of transitions and living a nonlinear life kind of became the big idea. And then lo and behold, I worked on this book for half a decade, and it arrives at this moment when the entire planet is going through a life transition.
Timing is everything. So you had interviewed 225 people on the life stories, and it seems that our expectations of how life unfolds can get in our way. Why do we tend to expect life to be linear, yet we find it to be increasingly nonlinear?
You know, I've thought a lot about that. And I think that it's sort of a historical aberration. Like those of us who were born, as I was, in the 20th century, had this idea. I mean, if you go back in history, like in the ancient world, they thought life was cyclical because they had seasons. They did not have linear time. Then in the Middle Ages, they thought life kind of climbs and peaks at middle age, and then it declines. And you think about that, right? So what that is saying is, if life peaks at middle age, and I have, as you know, in the book, I have these images that I found, like dozens and dozens of them from the Middle Ages, saying that's no new love at 40, that's no new job at 50, that's no retiring and relocating and starting over in some ways in your 60s or your 70s. It was incredibly unforgiving. And then in the 20th century, kind of with the birth of science, we were told that life is a linear arrow of progress, right? And so everyone from Freud to Piaget to Erikson with the 8 stages of development, the 5 stages of grief, over and over again, all of these are kind of linear constructs of life. And this reaches its peak with Gail Sheehy in the 70s, who publishes this blockbuster book, Passages, that many of us or our mothers read. And that said that everyone's going to do the same thing in your 20s and 30s, and then everyone's going to have a midlife crisis at 39 and a half. And this was so pervasive, and it turns out to be bunk, actually, to not be accurate. And so kind of the big idea that emerged in my conversations is that the idea of the linear life is dead. The idea that we're going to have one job, one home, one relationship, one spirituality, one source of happiness from adolescence to assisted living, like this is just gone. And it's been replaced by what I call the nonlinear life. And this nonlinear life, which has many twists and turns, has a lot of, I mean, anybody listening to this conversation, right? This is about retirement. Like just the basic idea that in retirement, you can reimagine yourself or recreate yourself or pick up passions that you long had that you maybe did not have time for, or start a new venture or relocate and develop a new friend circle. These ideas are all wonderful byproducts, kind of benefits of the nonlinear life that everybody listening to us enjoys. The problem is that doing that is challenging. And the way we do it, the way we move from being employed to being employed in a different way, from living in one location to living someplace else, to having our house full of kids, to being an empty nester, all the way, the mechanism for dealing with those changes is a life transition. And there has not been a book on life transitions, a major book, in 40 years. Like this is a concept that we have expelled from our culture. And a lot of what I've been believing for years that we need to do is kind of re-understand and re-embrace the idea of a life transition as a meaningful way to get through a change in your life. And then, as I said, now suddenly it's urgent and everybody realizes, oh my gosh, I'm going through this. I need help.
Bruce, you mentioned the expectation about the linear life. How did you find that different between generations, like boomers to millennials to Gen Xs?
Yeah, that's such a smart question. And it's something that I've, even since this book has come out and clearly tapped into a nerve, I mean, this book has gone through 4 printings in 10 days. It's like, it's urgently needed right now. I'm feeling this even more. So what I found was that this idea of nonlinearity of change is that Xers, like Gen Xers, get it more intuitively than do boomers, and millennials even more than Xers. There's something, I sort of have been referring to this as the transition gap, that there's a particular gap, I would say, between millennial children in their 20s and early 30s and their parents who are boomer parents in their 50s, 60s, or 70s, right? Because the parents are looking at the children and thinking, wait, hold on. Like, you're having a baby before you get married? Right? Or you're leaving one job before you even know the next job, or like you're moving to a new town and you have no clue what you're going to do when you get there. Like that was not done when the 50 plus generation was in their 20s and 30s. And so that generation, and by the way, I am part of that generation. I was born in 1964, so I'm technically the tail end of the baby boom. We're all haunted by the ghost of linearity. We expected to have that one job and one relationship and one home. And it's harder for us. So I think it's more intuitively a life skill. I think the millennials get it, that they're going to have, whatever, 15.7 jobs, 11.7 moves, and much more change. And those of us who have had to learn this skill, we are learning it, but it's not as natural to us as it is to our children and grandchildren.
As you went along through the interviews, what surprised you most about what was emerging early on? And what surprised you after you and your team completed the coding?
The first thing that surprised me is that the skill set to navigate a life transition that has to do with a relationship, like leaving a marriage, losing a loved one, getting divorced, adopting, having a children. I would have thought that the skill set for navigating a relationship transition versus a work transition, right? When you, maybe you lose a job, maybe you start an adventure, maybe you get retired, you know, versus a medical one relating to your body, right? Maybe you've gotten a diagnosis or you lose your limbs in an accident or you get cancer or, you know, have trouble walking or whatever it might be. I thought that it would be a different toolkit for each of these different life transitions. And I was just plain flat wrong. Like, it turns out that the basic steps, like, of navigating the, you know, as we can get into this as we move along, but life transitions have three phases. As you know, from my book, there's the long goodbye where you say goodbye to the old self. There's the messy middle where you shed habits and begin new ones. And then there's the new beginning where you unveil your new self. That basic archetype right there, that structure, which is incredibly comforting to people because it turns out there are things you can do, that's the same no matter what you're doing. So here I am on a retirement wisdom podcast. What I'm saying is not any different from a podcast that I taped yesterday aimed toward millennials or one I'm going to tape tomorrow aimed toward work transitions. It's the same toolkit. So that's the first thing that surprised me. The second thing that surprised me as I was doing it is that half of them are voluntary and half of them are involuntary, right? So I went into it thinking that most of these transitions would be something happened to you, right? You got a diagnosis, you were laid off, you lost your limbs, you got cancer. Because a lot of the ones that inspired me were things that happened to me. Turns out, yet again, I was wrong. 53% of our life transitions are involuntary, but 47% are voluntary. And I'm guessing people who are listening to this conversation can relate to that, right? In retirement, they say, finally, I'm going to make the change, right? I'm an empty nester now, right? I've either put the kids or mostly put the kids through college, or I want to move, or I want to bike more, or right, open up an Airbnb, or travel more, or whatever. These are still life quakes. These are still big life changes, but we initiate them. So that was a surprise. The last thing I'll say gets to the second half of your question, which is something that surprised me when I was coding. I'm actually sitting here in my office in Brooklyn as we're having this conversation, and I had this team of 12 people who gathered here more or less for a year. And one day I said to them, "So, guys," and it's a bunch of millennials, as you might imagine. And I said, "Tell me something that you noticed in the coding that I did not notice when I was doing the interviews." And this one kid, Robin, who is an undergraduate and economics major, he said, "People move." I was like, "Well, that's interesting." So we went back and we re-looked through the 1,000 pages of transcripts. And sure enough, 61% of people moved in the course of their life transition. They relocated houses, they changed countries, they moved their offices, they repainted, they remodeled, right? They did something, and that's not even counting the kinds of moves that are exercising more, taking up biking. Talked to a woman who stepped down from a career teaching college chemistry in Alabama, and she got stomach cancer. Her husband didn't want to take care of her. She's like, "Well, I'm not going to take care of you. I'm sick." She leaves this marriage. Her childhood dream was being a ballerina. And her Asian American hard-driving parents didn't support that. So she started taking adult ballet. So that's a different kind of moving. So 61% of the people moved in the course of their life transition. And I bring that up as a surprise because what happened during the pandemic? Lo and behold, I don't know about you, but 61% of the conversations I'm in, people are talking about moving. Mm-hmm. And that gets to the point. Like, these life transitions, these life quakes are meaning vacuums. And the life transition is the way that we restore meaning, is that we kind of rewrite and remake our life narrative that allow us to respond. So, like, life gets us stuck, and a transition is how we get unstuck.
So you mentioned life quakes, and Bruce, I'm curious, how do disruptors become life quakes?
Yeah, so this is a terminology in my book, so let me just unpack it. So back to the larger point. The larger point here is that we go through more changes of a wider variety of aspects of our lives over a much wider span in our lives than most people anticipate. So I tallied up all of the changes that people experience in their lives, and I came up with 36. Okay. So that's one life change every 12 to 18 months. But most of these are small, and most of these we get through. So I call this a disruptor, and I called it a disruptor because I didn't like the other language that was out there. The other language that is out there was things like stressor or crisis. But as I said, some of these are wonderful, like getting married is a disruptor. Having a child is a disruptor. Getting a pet can be a disruptor. Moving can be a disruptor. Retiring can be a disruptor. And again, most of these we get through. So that's one disruptor every 12 to 18 months. And by the way, like that's more often than many people see a dentist. But one in 10 of those becomes a life quake, and it's a massive life change. So why is it? And so that's 3 to 5 times in our lives. And by the way, the average length of time to navigate this is 5 years. So you think we go through 3 to 5, they take 4 or 5 years. That's 25 years. That's half of our adult lives. We are in transition, and kind of back to kind of my general enterprise here, that life is in the transitions, unveils the first new model for how to navigate life transitions in 50 years. So your question is, what makes a disruptor become a life quake? So I would say some are just timing. It happens that this event is like kind of the last straw, and finally you make the big change. Some is magnitude, like twisting your ankle and being, you know, having to be on crutches for a month is different than getting an osteogenic sarcoma, as I did at 43, and I was on crutches for 2 years. So that's just a magnitude issue. But the thing that really struck me and fascinated me that I'm just almost prepared to state definitively is not in the literature of human change, and I feel like I know this literature pretty well, is that they tend to clump, right? So just when you retire, you wreck your car, right? Or just when you're about to move, your daughter has an anxiety disorder and your mother-in-law needs cataract surgery. Like they tend to clump. And again, some of this is coincidence, but a lot of it I've become convinced is these disruptors or life quakes, they tend to kind of weaken your immune system, if you know what I mean. Like suddenly, like you're beaten down by this one life quake and along comes something else. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know what? It's just added to the pile. And that I have to say, the thing that people have written me in the weeks that life is in the transitions has been out there is, oh my gosh, I went through one of these periods where it just felt like life was coming at you from all ways. And they felt like I felt like there wasn't really a book out there. And so this pileup phenomenon is something I feel like we need to spend more time talking about.
That's a great point. You always feel like you're at least double teamed and sometimes triple teamed.
Yeah. And by the way, and then you're living with somebody. So this raises another interesting point, right? Which is that the pandemic is the first collective involuntary life quake of this magnitude that the world has been through in a century, right? So what that means is if you're living with somebody, not a lot of people live alone, particularly in retirement, as we know, but if you're living with somebody, it's not just you. It may be somebody else is also going through a life quake, and you may going through them in different ways and in different paces. And that turns out to be interesting, which is, it turns out that a big market for this book is people going through a life transition who want help. But a bigger market is people who are kind of the co-pilot or the coach or the support structure for somebody going through one. And they just feel like helpless, and they're looking for things to be able to tell their loved one.
It's very true. And I see in my coaching work on the retirement side, I've had people call. I had one woman I'm thinking in particular who said, my husband needs you. He just doesn't know it yet.
And so do you offer advice to her, or you insist on talking to the husband in this case?
I got background from her, but then I work with her husband.
Yeah. See, this is interesting to me. Like there's, of course, one of my tools, as you know, is about how to navigate this is to share it, is to find the support. And one of the things that I find is that people like different support. This was another surprise to me. Like some people like comforters, like, I love you, Susie, you're going to get through it, I believe in you. And some people like nudgers, like, I love you, Susie, but maybe you should try this. Like maybe you should call AA, or maybe you should, you know, get off your sofa and start exercising, or maybe you should go on whatever, some dating site and start to put yourself out there. It's been, you know, X number of years since your spouse died. So some people like nudgers, but some people like slappers, like, okay, Susie, I love you, but you got to get over yourself at this point. It's time for you to stop complaining and take control of your life. And so one of the things I like to tell people is like, don't assume that just because you like one type of advice, that the person you're giving advice to likes the same type of advice. I mean, it may be as simple as just asking them, do you want support or do you want actually suggestions?
Very helpful.
Yeah, one of the key themes here, obviously, is change, right? And the ability for people to change. I think this is a very positive aspect. From my perspective, in your book, when you mentioned, I think it was towards the end of the book, that you discovered that we are wired and capable to change all the time. I think that's great for people to know that and feel that. How so?
Well, again, this allows me to sort of attack a notion that many people listening to us grew up with, which is the idea that you have a fixed trait, right? You are a extrovert or an introvert, right? Or you have a personality that's like this, or you have a set of skills or strengths that are like that. That was an extremely popular, the dominant, maybe even the overwhelming kind of universal consensus of how many of us were raised. Turns out, dead wrong. You don't have one set of skills, one set of personality traits, one set of ways of acting. It changes. It evolves. We now know a lot more about how the brain is wired and how we are made than when a lot of these truisms kind of locked in when many of us were younger or, God forbid, in school decades ago. And we now know that the human mind, the human body, is capable of change. In fact, we now know that the body tends to instinctually understand that it needs to change even before our minds sometime accept it. So the body can go first in telling us. That's why the body reacts to stress, or the body can start to make changes, or you can begin to feel like you want to move or make a change or leave your job or reimagine some aspect of your life. You may feel it in your gut before you mentally actually verbalize it and articulate it. Because we know the change is so powerful in our lives that it will find a way. Even if it has to hobble us and put us flat on our backs, as any of us of a certain age have had happen to us, makes us realize, okay, I need to make a change. So your body may lead you, you know, your mind may lead you, your heart may lead you, but you are capable of rewriting yourself. And the idea, and again, if people take one thing away from this, is that these expectations are culturally created. If you were alive in 1500, you would have thought, I'm peaked at 40, I'm done. And if you were alive in the 1940s, you might have been told, you hit a trough at 40 and you're done. That is wrong. You can change. And that's why my book is, the subtitle is Mastering Change at Any Age. That is how we are made. It does happen. It can happen to you.
And when we look back at them, these transitions often turn out to be such valuable turning points. Why do we resist transitions?
It's the oldest story ever told. The oldest story ever told is, you know, the burning bush and the desert and Moses, you know, hears the voice of God and God says, I have picked you to go liberate your people. And he's like, no, you got the wrong guy. Like, I stutter, like, not me. Like, what are you talking about? Like, resistance is part of it. It's scary. Transitions are difficult. It's hard. You know, I talk a lot about these iconic stories that we have in our. We want to think our life is a fairy tale, and the fairy tale has a hero and a happy ending. But guess what? A fairy tale also has a wolf. And then halfway through our story, a wolf appears, or an ogre, or a dragon, or a troll, or a downsizing, or a tornado, or a death, or a pandemic. There is no fairy tale without the wolf. The wolf is what makes the hero come alive. So you can't banish the wolf. And that's okay, because if you banish the wolf, you're going to banish the hero. And we all have to be the hero of our own story. And at some point in the process, the hero is going to balk, is going to get scared, is going to deny it, is going to say, I can't get through it. You know, and I'm here to say, I was where you are. And I met a lot of people. And if you've even read 10 pages of my book, you know, they went through things that you're going to be really happy you never went through. And they got through it. And you can too. Of course, it's difficult. That doesn't mean it can't happen, because it's going to happen anyway.
And to that point, the second part of your book offers a great set of tools for managing these transitions. And one of them is creativity. And I'm curious, how can creativity be used in transitions, especially in the life quakes?
Well, so in a fundamental way, what is a life transition? A life transition involves like saying goodbye to the old life and then creating the new life. So they're in the middle, you know, in the beginning, and the tools involved identifying what emotions you struggle with, right? Using rituals to say goodbye. But in that messy middle, the middle part of it, it involves fundamentally two things. The first is shedding, like saying goodbye to certain things. I liked that old life, or I liked being with that person, or I liked having that money or that status or two knees I was born with as opposed to one artificial knee or whatever it might be. So you have to shed certain things. But guess what? I can't jump on the trampoline anymore, or I need to shed weight, or I need to shed my expectation that I can boss people around, and because I was a, you know, executive and now I am just another volunteer. So people shed things, and when they do, that creates room for this creativity. And this also surprised me. Like, I kind of feel a bit like adult, like, oh, of course, but it was amazing. People use astonishing acts of creativity. They sang, they danced. I talked to someone who lost her job, got depressed, played ukulele through her transition. I talked to a former Army Sergeant, Zach Herrick, who had his face blown off by the Taliban. 31 surgeries between the tip of his nose and the tip of his chin, including sewing his tongue back on. He learned to cook, to write poetry, and to paint. He's like, I used to splatter the enemy with bullets, and now I splatter the canvas with paint. Like, he was on the verge of suicide multiple times. He painted himself back to life. And that's what the creativity does. It's like it does what creativity has always done, which is that allows us to imagine a better world, and then we're on our way to creating that better world. And just an example, I mean, again, what happened when the pandemic hit? What did everybody do? It was a joke. They started baking, right? We sourdoughed our way through coronavirus. And I was not surprised, because, like, that's what it is. You get your hands dirty and you're making something, and you have some control over a world that you seem to have no control over, and it tastes good. So it's like creativity is a really inspiring part of the process of reinventing yourself.
So one thing I was thinking about while I was reading your book is financial literacy of all things, because our two youngest, we have four kids, one just graduated from college in the pandemic and is working from home in her first job out of college. And our youngest, our son, is heading off to college in person in Boston next week. But they both were very focused on talking about the financial literacy courses they had in high school and how they were making decisions about credit cards and all these things. And I was impressed by it. And then I thought, boy, how can your work be used to prepare high school or college students with the transition skills they need for life? And so their expectations can be a little different. They can be better equipped.
Wow. Love this question. A couple things. First of all, a bit about money from my previous book, The Secrets of Happy Families, where there's a whole chapter on families and money. Families do not talk enough about money. 80% of children get to college without having a conversation with their parents about money, where it comes from, where it's going to, you know, how to understand it, what debt is, what a credit card is. Like, this is a huge problem. And parents feel like, oh, I don't want to burden my kid. And like, you're going to burden your kid much more with ignorance than you are with the skills to manage money. And I went to see a guy named, when I was working on Happy Families, I went to see a guy named Byron Trott, who is Warren Buffett's private banker. And he advises 100 of the 100 wealthiest families in this country. And he showed me a list, and I was like, oh, can I see the list? And he's like, no. And he slapped it back in his, his attaché. And he's the one who was telling me, I was telling him that my kids were young at the time, and that we had, you know, we did an allowance system where we had, we gave them some spending money and some saving money and some sharing money and some giveaway money. And he's like, no, you should let them do what they want. I'm like, no, we want to teach them skills. He's like, no, let them do what they want. I'm like, well, what if they, you know, what if they drive into a ditch? Like, what if they, you know, don't have the right money for something they want to buy in 6 months? And he said one of my favorite things about families and money I've ever heard, which is it's much better to drive into a ditch with a $6 allowance than a $60,000 a year salary or a $6 million inheritance. So you've got to find a way, folks, to talk to your, especially your rising, your teenagers and rising college students about money, because every conversation about money is a conversation about values. But to your larger point about life transitions, I think that I love this question. And I think it's incredibly important that we understand college in particular as the first collective transition that most people in college are ever going to have gone through, right? So you've got, you know, what is a life transition? And then layer that onto college and kind of late adolescence in general. It's saying goodbye to your old self. It's the long goodbye, right? So the old self. Your parents took care of money. You lived with them. They gave you all your meals, right? They provided. You've got to say goodbye to that sense of total dependence. Then there's a messy middle where you shed certain habits and create new ones, like experiment, try new things. Like that's exactly what happens in late adolescence. And then you unveil your new self, write a new story, and then you're ready for the next phase of your life. And what did I just say a few minutes ago? What's the average length of a life transition? 4 or 5 years. That's exactly what that period of life is like. So if we reframe kind of late adolescence, college, whatever, you might be in the military, you might be in a community college, you might go into the workplace, you might take a gap year. The pandemic, of course, is going to, you know, reshuffle all of those expectations of how we spend adolescence. But if you look at this as a period of time where it's your first shared life quake and life transition, and you look at it as a time where you're going to make some mistakes, learn some new things, but fundamentally build life transition skills, then that is going to serve you the next time you're going to have a life transition, because they're going to keep coming irregularly, but often enough in your life.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate that. One last question. What advice would you offer someone listening who's perhaps transitioning to retirement earlier than they planned?
Well, that planning is that ghost of linearity. What does that mean? What does that mean is that as a practical level, it means you're moving from a time of life where one job was perhaps the defining way you scheduled your time and way you built your identity and possibly even the primary way that you made your income. But you're transitioning into a different phase. And a lot of, you know, what we have to do, I mean, it's interesting, what I'm actually now going to do is go into kind of recreate this life story project where I'm going to talk to people about their work lives. And, you know, the more that I dig in to the way we work today, what I've come to appreciate even more than maybe I have fully realized is that we don't have one job anymore. We have a collection of jobs. We don't work only during the workday. We work in lots of times of our day. Only a quarter of us work a regular work week. Half of us have a side hustle. So what you're really talking about is transitioning into a time of your life when you're going to have a variety of things that are going to give you meaning, right? Because fundamentally what a life quake is a meaning vacuum. And what fundamentally a life transition is a forge to create new sources of meaning. So the advice I would give to somebody retiring kind of quote unquote early versus someone retiring quote unquote on time versus quote unquote late is those terms don't mean anything anymore. And in fact, you have an opportunity to reconsider the basic building blocks of your meaning. I call them the ABCs of meaning. There's agency. That's what you do, make, create, your work. B is belonging, your relationships, your community, your friends, your neighbors. And then your C is a cause, a higher calling, something bigger than yourself, some purpose, some way of giving back. So what I would say to someone transitioning into retirement at any phase of their life is, this is an opportunity to look at the basic building blocks of what gives you meaning and rebalance them, reweight them in a fundamental way. Maybe you want to spend less time working and more time with your family. Maybe you've been a primary caretaker and you want to give back. Maybe you've been giving back and you're burning out. You want to do something for yourself. Whatever it is, look at this as a meaning-making moment. And then fundamentally, always remember this. Transitions work. 90% of the people I talked to said they got through their life transition. So whatever you're struggling with, whatever transition you're in, if you come on this journey with me, I'm going to introduce you to people. I'm going to give you actual tools and things. You can do one thing tonight and something else next week or 3 months from now, so that whatever you're dealing with, whatever transition you're in, whatever's keeping you awake at night, we can do this a little bit better and a lot more effectively. Like, transitions work. We can get through this. There is wisdom out there.
Bruce, thank you so much. Great wisdom that you shared with us today. And the new book, Life is in the Transitions, Mastering Change at Any Age, highly recommend. It's a phenomenal resource and will totally change how you see these periods that you can master.
Thank you, guys. A pleasure to be with you.
Thanks, Bruce. Well, today was a great podcast with our guest, Bruce Feiler. Bruce, the author of Life is in the Transitions, Mastering Change at Any Age, and I'm sure this will be his 7th bestseller. Joe, what did you take away from today's conversation with Bruce?
Well, both the conversation and the book are game changers, in my opinion, working with a lot of people who are in transition and having gone through several myself as well, because it just changes how you see this whole topic, and especially around, first of all, expectations. and his point that they're cultural, and we all come to the how we view life with this set of expectations about how it should work, how it should be linear, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I saw it in my corporate career as an HR person where I had a lot of people worked on Wall Street who were always seemingly bumping up against a timetable they had set for themselves in their head about when they should be promoted, when they should get a certain compensation level, and it was a constant theme. And I remember thinking a lot, what are you in such a hurry for? It'll take care of itself. But people, you know, had this timetable that they were working on expectations. But I think the stats that he mentioned today and that he has in more detail in the book are really compelling about every 12 to 18 months, you can expect some type of disruptor, and every 3 to 5 times over the course of a lifetime, you can have these life quake events. I thought those are important. And secondly, his point that he talked about the skill set, that there's a fundamental skill set to handle transitions, and it's universal. It can work, whether it's a relationship, as he put it, a work transition, retirement, no matter what the transition, health one, it's going to be the same phases that it'll go through and the same things that will make a big difference. So I thought that was key. And then I loved his description of these events that happen, the disruptors and life quakes, being meaning vacuums. They really take the meaning out temporarily. And transitions are a way to really restore that meaning and purpose in life. So those are the ones that jumped off to me. How about you, Dennis?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I'll just piggyback on the meaning aspect. And he mentioned there's the three ingredients of a well-balanced life. And he called them the ABCs of meaning. And A is for agency, B is for belonging, and C is for cause. And that's so important because the agency is more about yourself. The B for belonging is more about community. And the C is more about cause or a calling or a mission. When you really reflect on that, this is a really good framework to really think about how meaning can really help us keep balance in our life. The entire book is just wonderful. As you said, it's a game changer. So I agree with that. The aspect of change is very important when it came to when it comes to retirement. And retirement is an opportunity, and he even said this in the podcast, an opportunity to reinvent ourselves, reinventing to try new things. It's a very positive way to think about it. The change is really hardwired in us. So we have the ability and the capability to change. And the skill sets that he pointed out in the book are extremely helpful and can really benefit people in this, no matter what kind of change or transition that they're going through. The last point is that in order to change, while things that happen to you, while the disruptors and the life quakes that happen to you, and he gave the statistics on voluntary and involuntary, they happen, you cause them or other things happen to you. The ability to move forward and the ability to navigate through the change is all voluntary. So we can't forget about that. It requires us to make a movement and to actually see where we are, use the opportunity to move forward. So read the book. It's a tremendous story. I'm sure you'll pick up a lot from it.
I'd echo that. I think it's useful if you're someone who's in a transition, anticipating transition, or as he pointed out, knowing someone who could benefit by this book. This is one that I expect to gift a lot because it's so universally useful, particularly younger people, I think, who may not be thinking along these lines in terms of the expectations and the non-linearity of life. So I highly recommend that. And there's a lot of very practical tools that he mentions in there, as well as the big picture findings from his research. So great book. And he's an excellent storyteller, as you can tell, as well. And that makes it a great read. So the book is Life is in the Transitions, Mastering Change at Any Age by Bruce Feiler. Thanks for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.